noisy and emotional protests against government-run health care have led many to consider the nature of American democracy. Certainly, we're watching some very free speech, but perhaps we're also listening to a decline of civil dialogue. Debates on democracy are hardly new. French political thinker Alexis de Tocqueville's 19th-century text, Democracy in America, explores many of the same tensions. Los Angeles Times columnist Gregory Rodriguez went back to reread de Tocqueville's observations, and he's concluded that whatever you may think of the protesters, quote, their brand of hot-headed, self-righteous, obnoxious, stick-it-to-the-man-ism is as American as apple pie. We want to know what you think. What about our nation's past political history has informed this American moment? Our number is 800-989-8255. Our email address is talk@npr.org, and you can join the conversation at our website. Go to npr.org and click on Talk of the Nation. Gregory Rodriguez joins us now from the studios of NPR West. He is a columnist with the Los Angeles Times. He's also the director of the California Fellows Program at the New America Foundation. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Now, de Tocqueville's book comes from the 1830s. What do you think he saw in that time that we're seeing in the U.S. of today?
Well, de Tocqueville was able to look at the pros and cons of the ideologies of liberty and equality. And as much as equality in the sense that we're all equal can spur innovation and creativity and entitlement and a belief in all our rights, it also has an underbelly. And no one really since then has written about that as well as de Tocqueville. And what he found really was that the sense of equality can also give us entitlement and self-righteousness and allow us to speak about things we know nothing about, because in a sense the flip side of feeling that we're just as good as everyone else is the resentment of the notion that someone knows or is ever better than you. So there's always this tension between climbing up the ladder and wanting those who may know more, the experts, the powerful. We like to bring them down to size. We don't like to think anyone's better than us or knows better than us or more than us.
Well, so it's your view that or his view that high principles, the principle that all men are created equal, somehow leads to a sort of low standard of behavior.
Well, it certainly leads to the sense that one thing it did, I think, de Tocqueville honed in on early was the sense that each man is able to figure things out himself, and so we have this strident individualism and this belief, and it's a beautiful belief. It's the core and the origins of America can-do-ism, but it's also the core and the origins of American sort of self-righteousness and know-it-all-ism. So, it's the flip side of the same coin. There's good in it, and there's bad in it. And the bad in it is that we go around thinking we all know the answers. And he was quite pointed when he talked about the ability of American to really shut, he put it, shuts himself up in his own breasts and affects from that point to judge the world. We all feel we have the right to judge the world from the limited knowledge within our own heads.
And that limited knowledge is probably really all we need, because we're all equal.
Precisely, and we can all figure it out ourselves. We don't need no darn experts.
Now, you write that the belief in equality obviously spurred innovation in this country. A lot of people who felt that there was absolutely no reason why they could not be captains of industry if they had a good idea and were able to work hard.
Absolutely. I mean, again, this is the beauty of America.
There's sort of no class system that would keep them down. That's the idea.
And this notion that we're constantly reborn and you can become who you want to be. But there's also
several times.
Precisely. And marry as many men as you want. But there's something implicit in that ideology that leads us to tear down traditions, to institutions, to constantly question. And the constant questioning and there's a certain implicit disrespect for tradition in American individualism and American democracy. There's a certain disrespect. We're constantly, the way I see it is, a country that prides itself on a million new births has to have a lot of deaths. That, in a sense, that we're constantly tearing stuff down to build it again.
Do you think that the sort of the two-sided coin, as you say, and that is we're looking at as we watch all of this political protesting and whatnot. Is it a good thing? Is it good for us to have a big, nasty national argument over an issue like health care?
That's a great question, and I don't think it's a good thing. However, I think as I write in my piece, it's not pretty, and it can be dangerous. I mean, I'm one of those people who's sort of appalled by the people bringing guns to some of these town halls. But my conclusion in this column was it's the price of democracy to have to suffer fools, and I think there are a lot of foolishness. I wish the debate were on the principles, but it's not that uncommon that political debates don't focus on the principles. I mean, to some extent, this is particularly nasty. It's peculiarly violent in its rhetoric, but I'm not sure it's that different than what we see day in and day out in American politics.
Well, now let's check with our listeners. We want to hear from you about how our nation's past political history has informed this particular political debate, this American moment. The number is 800-989-8255. You can email us, talk@npr.org, or you can go to the web, npr.org, and click on Talk of the Nation. I'm wondering, we're gonna pick up here on Kristen, who is in Burr Ridge, Illinois. Kristen, are we looking at an American phenomenon here?
Well, I think that what the gentleman, Mr. Fernandez, was speaking about.
Rodriguez, but you were close.
I'm sorry?
Rodriguez,
I'm sorry. When he was speaking, I could kind of resonate with him because right now, if you look back at historical presidents and what they did in history, for example, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, he was in office for two terms, and his enlargement of government responsibility sunk the private sector and the people weren't living high on the hog. It really didn't work that great. And, I mean, only after him, during the Industrial Revolution, was there a great fervor in the economy. And I feel as though the ideas about enlarging government going on right now, I think it's really important. For in other countries, like in Japan, my brother told me in the early 1900s, they tried like a stimulus. Didn't work. And frankly, if you kind of check in on what has happened before
and
see the results, I think it's very, very important to what you decide to apply to what's going on right now.
Okay. Gregory Rodriguez, we're looking at a healthcare plan, which, of course, we will not know how it turns out until it does turn out. I mean, we won't know if it works until we try it. But meanwhile, before we take that on, we can have a lot of fussing about it. What do you think? Do you think that this is just the sort of regular passage of whenever innovation comes is handed down to us from Washington, we all get upset?
Well, no, I think it's more than that. I think it's hard to disentangle all the issues involved. We're not just talking about health care, clearly. The caller here is not talking about health care per se. She's talking about the size of government. There are a lot of issues at play here, and some of them aren't being spoken about clearly. I mean, and there seems to be a lot of sublimated anger about a lot of things that's being funneled through this issue. So I think, in a sense, it would be very difficult to disentangle where all this anger and all this worry and all this fear is coming from. I do not believe it's all about healthcare. And I do think this is a pivotal moment. I do think this is a sense that the election, this is the second round of last November's election. I think we're talking about a changing America. We're talking about a black president. We're talking about a shift in the way we do business and the shift in the balance between private and public sector. And I think there's a lot of fear in the nation, with a lot of fear, particularly among older people. And I think it would be a mistake to think that all this anger is about the actual proposals, which very few people know about.
So it's just a sort of a generally directed anxiety, as one of our previous guests said during the course of this hour. People are upset and unhappy, and this is a place where
Absolutely.
They can talk about that upset and unhappiness.
Absolutely. I do believe it's very much part of a larger zeitgeist. I really do doubt.
I love that word zeitgeist got into our conversation.
so I think it would be nice if it weren't so raucous, if it weren't so boisterous. It would be nice if we took a little break and the president were able to come back in September to actually bring it down back to the issue at hand. But
just
let's see if he
dial
can
dial it down
off.
A bit.
I would hope so.
Well, let's see. Let's go out to Fort Collins, Colorado, and to Liam. Liam?
Hi. Yes. I'm thinking of the abolitionist period when people were actually beaten in Congress with canes by pro-slavery advocates. I think we've become sort of soft in that a few signs and some spittle-spewing anti-reform advocates are able to intimidate, like our congresswoman in Northern Colorado has totally dropped the ball. She's cowered. She's only meeting with 10 to 15, in one case 75 people, in very controlled meetings because she doesn't have the kind of gusto that, say, Barney Frank or Claire McCaskill have to confront these people and make them explain their positions.
And so she's just, you think she's ducking?
I'm sorry?
You think she's just ducking it?
Well, yes. I totally think she's ducking it. Also, I mean, she's not really given us any clear position one way or the other on any of the aspects of the health care reform. And I think the reason for that is, well, we have a very diverse district up here. It's urban on the Front Range, and then it goes out to the hinterlands on the rural plains. But even still, I think that in her case, she's underestimating the intelligence of the middle of the road and even the conservative voters. These are not what I would call regular conservatives, conservative people, as has already been mentioned. These are people who are, you know, highly emotional and feeling a whole lot of things. They're not just, in fact, as your guest just pointed out, they're not even talking about the issues because they don't even know what the issues are. Most of us don't.
Okay.
We're just emotionally, you know, on the right and the left, we're outraged about the healthcare situation. But I think that what we need to do is roll up our sleeves and have a few more Barney Franks and a few more Claire McCaskills and people who are not intimidated by a little bit of yelling. And I'm bothered by the guns at rallies, particularly where the president is.
Uh-huh.
I think that's very serious. But yelling, signs, come on. You know, if you've seen any abortion-oriented fight, you've seen...
Many of these same kinds of things happen. Well, thank you, Liam. We appreciate that. And here's somebody who pretty much agrees with you. Eric in Richmond, Virginia, who says, hot-headedness is in the history of our nation. I'll read the rest of it in just a second. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And here's the rest of Eric's email. This entire form of government, he says, and system of law was decided by men yelling at each other until they reached a begrudging conclusion that appealed to no one. The civility of more recent discourse in our nation's history has led the country to a place where many aren't happy. When calm discourse fails, isn't the next logical step to try discourse without civility's restraints? Now, there's a thought. Gregory Rodriguez, what do you think?
I think both of the previous comments are right on. But we are in this. This may be true historically about the level of civility and the previous caller's notion that our legislators should be willing to fight a bit and to fight back. But there is this level of constant, this perennial righteous indignation on both sides of the aisle that may be new in American history. I mean, it's partly the consequence of cable networks and the ability to keep people riled over time. That may have changed the equation a little bit. There's more levers, and there's more of an ability for people to manipulate public opinion in an instant these days. And I think there is a reason to worry about about over time. As much as I do believe that obnoxiousness is part of our political history, I'm not saying that we shouldn't worry about it, that there are, that it does have its dangers. But so far, we shouldn't overreact to it.
Okay, let's take another caller. This is Jeremy, who's in Upton, Massachusetts, where not so far from where Congressman Barney Frank had a fair sized fit yesterday at one of these meetings. Jeremy?
Hi, I wanted to ask for the commentator's thoughts on the change in the state of the national dialogue since, for example, the mid and latter 19th century, where it would seem to me, based on newspapers and records and so on, that not only was the level of engagement of the citizenry much higher, but perhaps also the level of dialogue going on was perhaps more substantial.
I'm not sure the level of engagement was higher. I mean, we can look at African Americans weren't terribly welcome to engage in the late 19th century. So I think the level of engagement actually is higher now. I think the ability for the elites to control the argument in the 19th century, even most of the 20th century, was much greater. There is more democracy now. There is more of an ability for the average Joe or Jane to engage in the system, and that's part of what's going on. We are getting people who can say whatever they want at any time, and I think the previous caller's point is well taken in that at what point does do legislators no longer fear this new democratized media world? At what point do they fight back?
Gregory Rodriguez is a columnist for the Los Angeles Times. He joined us from NPR West. You can find a link to his column on our website at npr.org. Gregory Rodriguez, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
Tomorrow, longtime New York Times food critic Frank Bruni on battles won and lost at the dining table, and I hope you will join us. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer in Washington.